Hello. We are now in the virtual instruction phase of this course. I want to say just a word about listening to classes before we begin. We're primates. We believe what we see and we imagine what we hear. That means when we are listening to a class rather than watching it, our brains are differently involved in processing what's going on. Without seeing other people around us paying attention, our own attention system behaves differently, and our imagination engages, and we listen to sentences less with the process of translating from words to notes on a pad, and more as though we were listening to drama. The drama quotient of this class, I'm afraid, is still lamentably low, but it will help to take at least one break in the course of the class. Just hit pause and spend a little time looking at notes you are taking or in some other way engaging your mind in a different mode before you come back to the class. Without the usual digressions and foolish side stories in which I might be engaging, the lecture should be more streamlined and it is shorter. We don't need a full hour and 40 minutes to do what it might have otherwise taken 5 minutes over to achieve. With that preface, let me then return to the subject we have been discussing already for 2 weeks, which is the comedy of the First Amendment in the world of the 21st century. Our most important effort to keep our civil liberties under the new conditions between the citizen and the state in the world of comprehensive surveillance and so-called big data analysis. A tool for securing our liberty, which is more effective in its 18th century language and its 18th century ideas than the Fourth Amendment, whose tragedy we first pursued. Let me re-summarize just briefly the course of the discussion up till now. The First Amendment is a single sentence, an 18th century idea rendered in one indivisible single sentence. This is not the way our traditional constitutional law approaches it. Given the common law nature of our constitutional jurisprudence, the case-by-case exploration of doctrinal space, the First Amendment is, for the constitutional law professor, a collection of clauses, an establishment clause, a free exercise clause, a speech clause, a press clause, and so on. That approach organizes the jurisprudence, explains the cases, produces a set of decisions that we can rationalize or at least comment upon as a coherent whole when we are really talking about one-eighth of the head of the pin. My method in this course is to attempt to understand the Constitution of the future by rendering it in relationship to the deeper Constitution of the past. That is to say, to take the technological discontinuity, the enormous social change that arises from the growth of digital communications technology intermediating every human activity, and to try to subject the trajectory of constitutional law over the long span the secular span, to the disruption that that technology both causes and reduces. For it is true in a way that the technology reduces a disruption in the sense that it draws us back to the unitary meaning of the First Amendment as a whole. It gives us a reason to ask, not within the silos of the particular clauses, and in particular, not as a disjunction between the freedom of speech and the freedom of the press, but the whole of the objective of the First Amendment, that is to, as I said, to find the limits of legislative power in an imperial constitution, that task is made more necessary by the technological disruption of society and the creation of the networked state. We are thrown back on first principles in the context of broad social change, broad enough that the existing verticals, the discussion of the speech clause and the press clause and the assembly right and the petition right, the breadth of what is happening compels us to a breadth of response which crosses the barriers, the verticals, these little pigeonholes the clausification of the Constitution brings about. So the first principle on which I have posed this discussion is that we are understanding the First Amendment as a single idea expressed in a single sentence. But as I said in our first meeting on this subject, the sentence is itself complex, and its complexity rests in its careful selection of relevant verbs. We've already understood how, with respect to the beginning of the sentence, a statement that Congress cannot legislate with respect to an establishment of religion is designed to indicate non-interference by the imperial government in the religious understandings of the state governments, which varied from non-establishment to establishment across the full range, and which therefore compels the drafters of the amendment in the first Congress to accept that the limitation on imperial legislative power is a limitation on change of any kind in the structure of establishment. That the state government's choices on that subject are not available for legislative preemption in the imperial power. With respect, however, to the free exercise of religion, the drafters use the verb to prohibit to indicate that what the legislative power in the states may not do is to foreclose the free exercise of religion by prohibitory regulation. This is in direct dialogue with current jurisprudence in the United States Supreme Court over the question of whether secular regulations undertaken for secular purposes, health insurance rules, or in the older cases like Wisconsin against Yoder, compulsory universal education rules enacted for the purpose of making broad secular decisions which have an effect in burdening religious exercise are constitutional. The use of the verb to prohibit clearly indicates that Congress is not allowed to interfere with the free exercise of religion in prohibitory fashion. It cannot so foreclose religious practice as to amount to prohibition. That, with respect to cases like Hobby Lobby, ought to indicate a direction of travel, but it isn't the direction of travel that is under current discussion in the United States Supreme Court. For our purposes, the most important verb in the sentence is the verb to abridge. What Congress and the legislative power, ultimately not only of the states, but of the federal imperial power, but of the states, may not do is to legislate to abridge freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition government for a redress of grievances. The primary form, the modality of legislation disallowed by the First Amendment then is abridgment of freedoms of speech, press, assembly, and petition. And here, as I have suggested last time, we meet the importance of the idea of abridgment not only as foreshortening, truncation, or closure, but also the idea of abridgment as discrimination or the imposition of inequality. To abridge the rights of some, that is to say, by enlarging or tolerating the enlargement of the rights of others. A statute abridges freedom when it forecloses it uniformly or burdens it severely in a comprehensive way, but also abridges the right when it changes the extent of the right from person to person, or place to place, or time to time. When the legislation itself works inequality, it is abridging the freedoms that must be protected. This concept that abridgment is what the legislative power may not accomplish is, by virtue of the choices that are made in the sentence, clearly indicated as different from the forms of legislative misbehavior that are otherwise foreclosed by the amendment. Prohibition of certain religious freedoms or any legislation with respect to establishment of religion. Here, with respect to these named rights, we needn't number them. They may be all the part of one, or they may be four or six or eight, but they are contained in the words freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition government for redress of grievances. With respect to this, abridgment is what is not allowed, and we have seen that the choice of the verbs, the modulation of the verbs through the sentence, tells us that we should be alert to the nuances of abridgment, which I tried in the last lecture to discuss. The third of the points touched upon the fulcrum of last week's class, and still the primary subject of today's, is the meaning of the portion of the sentence which refers to non-abridgment of freedom of speech or of the press. And here I began by pointing out that the nature of that or, the proposition that there is a freedom of speech or of the press, is in part, at least in part, the historical outcome of differential treatment between speech, exchange of words, motions of the air, noises between people, and the output of the physical object, the thing of wood and metal called the press. As I pointed out, this is a distinction which is made in the history of the English law out of both common law and non-common law parts. The efforts of the royal courts to limit their jurisdiction over words, when in the course of the 16th century a fall in the jurisdictional minimum for access to the royal courts, that is to say, a change in the value of 40 shillings, brought a great deal of the ordinary hum of defamation, the two iconic values, thief and whore, being thrown around and attributed over the back fence and in the marketplace, when a flood of such cases came to the royal courts, and they responded by the evolution of complex doctrine designed to remove cases from their docket, which seemed both displeasing and trivial to the prophets of justice and the administration of the state. The various doctrines which evolved for limiting damages, for requiring proof of special damages, for limiting access on the basis of the innuendo or the implied rather than expressed defamatory meaning of the words, and all sorts of other related doctrines were essentially there for the purpose of keeping cases out of the King's Bench and the Common Pleas. The control of the writing, of printing, of the social power presented by the ability to make pamphlets and tracts and distribute them widely, that control rested in the executive authority of the crown and in its conciliar justice system, particularly the court called the Star Chamber, made of all the judges and the chief political officers of government. And because the political purpose of the regulation and the depth of its power was related to a perceived political valence of the print, of the press as an object, that where it went, either religious or political subversion might easily follow. The nature of the regulations imposed upon the press in Star Chamber and associated conciliar jurisdictions are very strong. The press is regulated both by the physical regulation of the object, presses themselves are licensed, and by the licensure of everything they printed, that is, by a regime of censorship that assumes that each work printed on any one of the licensed presses will be also itself approved. A system of regulation which sustained itself for roughly 200 years from the first adoption of movable type printing in England in the 1480s until the lapse of the licensing system for censorship of printed works in the 1690s. The two distinct historical lines of regulation between the liability for defamatory words or seditious libel on the one hand and the work of the systematic executive regulation of printing and printed works on the other is a sufficient distinction that the late 18th century draftsman speaking of these forms of regulation will inevitably think of speech as under one legal regime and press as under another. This idea that to a lawyer's mind one conceives of regulations about speech as different in character from regulations about printing is sufficient, not necessarily complete, but sufficient to explain the adjunctive rather than the disjunctive nature of the or in the First Amendment, that Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech or of the press, doesn't necessarily imply two rights, but it certainly implies two historically distinct, legally different modes of regulation. And by saying that A or B are both equally not to be abridged, the result is to indicate not necessarily that A and B are two different things, but certainly that they are abridged in two different ways. This historical distinction in legal regulation, then, which I have pointed to as the beginning source of the semantic differentiation between speech and press, doesn't imply that there is no other distinction between the freedom of speech and the freedom of the press, but it indicates a basis for the grammatical distinction which the sentence affords us, and suggests why it is that the ultimate 20th century view of the speech clause in one place and the press clause in another may be an artificial pigeonholing that doesn't analytically need or benefit us in any way. Of course, to the 20th century thinker, to Justice Potter Stewart, for example, in the University of California Law Review article on the freedom of the press, which was one of his primary scholarly works on the court, the view that the freedom of the press is clearly different from freedom of speech followed naturally from the state of 20th century technology. The press, in the 20th century world, was a highly capitalized business grown out of the thing of wood and metal, not quite so reified into the presses themselves, but definitely suggesting a form of production unique in the economy, a structure of industrial production and dissemination of information on industrial scale in disciplined time. And both newspapers and electronic broadcasting, radio and television, had the character of industrial, highly capitalized undertakings. This, the industrial press, the industrial media, as we came to call them, justified, at least superficially, the insight that the constitutional regime with respect to individual speech, the man standing on the soapbox, and the regulation of these immense and powerful businesses, constituting, at least in their own opinion, a separate social force, the fourth estate, in capital letters, if you please, that distinction seemed natural under the 20th century circumstances. Indeed, the ebb and flow of First Amendment cases in the United States Supreme Court in the 20th century, which, as I've pointed out, were the only ebb and flow of First Amendment cases in the 20th century, in the history of the United States. The 19th century was not fertile in First Amendment jurisprudence, as I pointed out two lectures back, for a single overwhelming reason, namely slavery. Control over information flow is an inherent part of the system of slavery and race control in the United States, and rules like those prohibiting the mailing of abolitionist literature were incompatible on their face with what the First Amendment seems to say Congress may not do. At any rate, the 20th century jurisprudence of the First Amendment, from the opinions we know of Holmes in Abrams and Skenk in the immediate aftermath of the First World War, the 20th century First Amendment cases are the First Amendment cases of the clausified Constitution, and those cases in their ebb and flow rightly appeared to distinguish quite sharply the activity of the speaker from the activity of the press. The speech cases of the 1940s, for example, are largely cases generated out of the oppressive behavior of the United States governments, municipal, state, and federal, to the Jehovah's Witnesses. The cases of the 40s, whether they are ultimately cases about the flag salute or about the right of individuals to proselytize door to door, the cases are very largely about religious minority seeking to express its views and increase its membership in a hostile society, and they generate all sorts of disputes, which in a historical piece on the subject I characterized once upon a time as the cases of the little man and the comp. They lead us even to the most troublesome of all of the lines of Supreme Court jurisprudence, the ones that hold areas of speech entirely outside the range of the First Amendment. All of that begins from a single point of origin, Chaplinsky against New Hampshire. The little man, as so often in these cases, Jehovah's Witness, who referred to the policemen engaged in the usual moving them along and keeping them down behavior as fascist and goddamned racketeer. To the Supreme Court, these were, quote, fighting words, words more akin to a blow, lying outside the scope of protection for speech under the First Amendment, a category which then later came to include obscenity, and which became the basis for the notion that the idea that Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech meant only make no law abridging some freedoms of speech and not others. Chaplinsky, which has such fertile progeny in the rules against obscene speech and printing, begins then, as I say, in the smallest of contexts, the face-to-face slanging match between the citizen and the policeman of the state. This is the little man and the cop in the same way that Finer against New York, the soapbox orator pulled down by the police and dragged away so that the white supremacist crowd around him will not harm him. These cases are cases in which the freedom of speech is understood in the most intimate terms, the ones which for us in our present situation may be thought of as times when the virus could spread, when there's actual spittle flying and there's particles of human interaction emitted and received. On the other hand, the press, of course, is those great bastions of capitalist information distribution, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Red Lion Broadcasting, etc. And in these places, the question for the court seems much more to rest on the relationship of large entities in society. To the question of the possibility, well known, of anticipatory suppression for government secrets in the Pentagon Papers case, to the right of access by broadcasters to public facilities such as prisons in KQED against Houchins, to the nature of the regulation that the Federal Communications Commission can impose on broadcasters at least at certain times of day with respect to the famous seven dirty words. In all of these, the size, the weight, the social significance of the entities involved, even if they are as comparatively small and comparatively marginal as the Pacifica Foundation's public interest, public service radio stations, all of these things are big, where the little man in Chaplinsky or Finer or even Anita Whitney making a speech to a political rally in California are not. The massiveness, the social ponderance and significance of the press becomes a significant background to the way cases are resolved. This, the sociological distinction, if you like, rather than the legal distinction between the Fourth Estate, a privileged but also responsible form of the American business, and the marginalized, the slightly disreputable, the religiously nonconformist, the individual in his most individual form, comes to differentiate not just the outcomes of cases, not just the creation of clause focus, this is a press case, that's a speech case, but also to underwrite some implicit understandings about the separateness, the difference of the press. In that sense, then, a historical legal set of distinctions which differentiated these objects from one another becomes, in the 20th century cases, a sociological distinction separating the atom of the individual from the large, complex polymers that are the ownership of CBS or the family business that is the New York Times. And therefore lent weight and credibility to the notion that the press clause protects a special component of society. As I suggested last time, that sociological differentiation, that use of the distinction between the institutionalized press and the mere individual in the 20th century First Amendment cases worked in the long run social harm. It was a major underlying factor in the growing belief in the course of the late 20th and early 21st century that the press, the media, the mainstream media were in one or another fashion a separate, isolated, and suspect part of society. The disruptive politics of the 21st century, whether they are associated with the current president of the United States or with the vice presidential candidacy of Sarah Palin in 2008, or the forces that aligned themselves under the rhetorical leadership of Spiro Agnew in the first Nixon administration, the forces that characterized themselves as hostile to the media or the press, the nattering nabobs of negativism, in Bill Sapphire's phrase spoken by Spiro Agnew's mouth, the predecessor of the fake news and the lamestream media of the last decade and a half, all of that monetizable hostility, all of that political capital going begging in distinguishing between the voter and the press, all of that arose in a sense from that form of sociological distinction which the Supreme Court did its best to further. It wasn't the lead speaker in that process, to be sure. The lead speaker in that process was the press, that is to say, the organized capital of the newspaper business itself. The press in the 20th century wanted to be distinguished. It wanted to be a special class. It wanted to have what we might call special rights embedded in the press clause of the First Amendment. It wanted a constitutional recognition of its status as the Fourth Estate. But it was never given to responsibility as it was given to claiming how responsible it was. Like most other institutions of society, it was perfectly happy to engage in warmongering at the opening of the 20th century, William Randolph Hearst's you give me the pictures, I'll give you the war, or for that matter in the Gulf War of 1991 or the extraordinary events of the present administration. The press has offered itself as the responsible party, fair and balanced. We report, you decide. And sought a kind of Olympian neutrality, well, honored in the breach rather than the observance, a symbol rather than a substance, But the agreement between the press and the Supreme Court on the essential difference and constitutional status of the press was an important cultural predeterminant of what we might call the mess we have now. Of course, the other and more important characteristic of what we have now is that neither legal nor sociological distinction between one form of communication and another can survive the disruptive effects of contemporary technology. The period in which it was possible to ask whether bloggers are or are not the press has come and gone. I don't mean that the occasional outburst of such unlogic it continues. It will continue some while longer, but analytically, it's apparent that the distinction has failed. The relationship between the press and Twitter, for example, has demonstrated in the 21st century how completely ineffective any such social analysis would be. Mr. Rupert Murdoch reaches more than 60% of the American population three or four different ways in his media empires, in his broadcasting interests, in his ownership of newspapers. And yet, with all the power, unequal power, to address the society that Mr. Rupert Murdoch has in everything running from the Wall Street Journal to the New York Post to Sky.fm, Mr. Rupert Murdoch is himself a prolific in the use of Twitter for personal expression. At least he seemed prolific until his frenemy Donald John Trump became president of the United States. Now everybody looks less prolific on Twitter, save the Russian bots. But Rupert Murdoch's relationship to Twitter, like the relationship of all the people who work for him to Twitter, has indicated very elegantly the absence of some form of gross proportion in which the little man speaking on his own is merely speech, and the Wall Street Journal is the press. The press, that is, the institutional form of the employment of a large number of employees in capitalism to produce and disseminate information, needs Twitter. The effort to compel journalists to engage in constant socially scrutinized and technically surveilled personal communication in order to promote their work at the factory is really quite astonishing, right? It's not the way we usually think of the industrial army of capitalism as working. In the 20th century, under the conditions of maximum technological inequality of communications, when, as A.J. Liebling said, the freedom of the press belongs to him who owns one, in the 20th century, the goal of the press lord was to keep his employees silent in every context except in the bylines he accorded them. Henry Luce, the 20th century press lord who founded Time, Life, and Sports Illustrated, Henry Luce required all of his reporters to get prior permission, editorial employees, editors as well as reporters, to get prior permission to write and publish books, an effort now required only by our intelligence services. The idea that the men, they were mostly men, and the occasional girls who wrote for you should have no voice outside the office, and that what they say can only be said through you, was taken for granted in much the same way that General Motors assumed that the people who worked for it built their cars at the factory and didn't build them on the weekends and sell them in competition. It would never have been the idea of the New York Times that its reporters should appear and speak on everybody's radio stations, only those owned by the New York Times. Of course, in the era of television, this was to some extent altered, as the face of journalism became a part of its promotability, but nothing like the current extraordinary intertwining of the personal social media communications of journalists and the interests of their publishing employers. In that sense, then, we can see that even at the pressiest end of the distinction in society between those who write for a living and those who don't, that even at the pressiest end of that, the continuum bends round and the personal forms of online speech become crucial to the activity. There isn't really press without speech in that sense anymore. When Twitter refers to itself as the free speech end of the free speech movement, it is merely putting on for show. It means, of course, to call attention, however, to that precise distinction between the press of the past and the press of now. Twitter's basic business model bargain, which is self-promotion services in return for surveillance, we will give you a way to conduct PR called tweeting, which will allow you to shape a segment of public opinion for yourself and work upon it in return for the right to look at all the traffic and to shorten every URL you promote in such a way that we get to watch people read it, that bargain. A peculiar bargain in a variety of ways, but characteristic of the geometry of 21st century media. That idea of DIY self-promotion in return for surveillance has no more profound set of fans in the world than the journalists. For the journalists in the Lucian universe of you publish here and I approve everything you say outside, the opportunity to have a PR machine that works for them 24/7 and followers of their own is the only thing that offsets the collapse of the advertising-supported digital newspaper and magazine. It's the only way that they can avoid a more direct and even more destructive participation in the business model meltdown. And so the journalists come to see the DIY PR engine that is Twitter and similar declaratory social media as the security blanket, or at any rate the tattered security napkin full of holes, which currently protects to the extent that there is any protection at all from the howling winds of technological readjustment. But that sociological cleaving to the merger of press and speech is only one of the ways in which this structure changes. And the or in the First Amendment most definitely must be adjunctive rather than disjunctive to make sense. For over at the speech end, on the other side of the continuum, where we used to see the little man and the cop, the soapbox speaker and the heckler's veto in the 20th century, we now see a variety of essentially overgrown speech acts becoming something like the press. Whether that's the Drudge Report or Breitbart, where we now perceive some kind of press, or at least media to be, or at the other end, the influencer culture and the forms of famous for being famous, now read my posts and scroll my pictures, element of 21st century celebrity, there's really no easy way at the other end where the expressive party is a natural person not also to notice that the distinction between personal speech and institutional communication has dissolved. And so when we ask whether someone is a journalist or a blogger, we are again engaged, even at the amateur end, in an unaskable or at least unresolvable question. The American press, A.J. Liebling said in another essay, reminds me of a $12 billion highly capitalized superheated fish cannery depending for its daily catch on a few guys in leaky rowboats. And that makes perfect sense as a kind of cartoon evocation of the difference between the infinite difficulty of reporting comprehensively on a complex society and the real behavior of even the most deeply funded and most advertising-rich oligopolists of the 20th century press. Reporting, in that sense, was always an activity of which there was far too little for the society enclosing the press, and now as the economics of journalism shift and hedge funds begin breaking up and throwing away the great American daily newspapers from Los Angeles to Chicago and on, in this world, the reporting is more than ever the activity of citizens. Soon, under existing economic circumstances, there will be nobody to report on the school board or the city council or the water board or the land use committee meetings anywhere in the United States outside the richest and most demographically concentrated cities. There will be nobody to report except the citizenry themselves. This very last month, the Australian Associated Press, the source of most of the local reporting in Australia, disappeared overnight. The Australian Associated Press, we should point out, was founded by a pioneering press lord in Australia, namely Rupert Murdoch's father. Here, the mechanisms of 20th century reporting, we pay a bunch of reporters and stringers to sit out there and telegraph or phone it in, and every newspaper gets the benefit, and so everybody seems to have a way of covering local news throughout the dispersed society that is Australia. All of that disappears as though it had no longer any function at all. Of course it has a function. What it doesn't have is a business model. And what replaces it are those dedicated bloggers, Wikipedia editors, and other forms of individuals collectively joining together to provide a view of society, an encyclopedia everyone can edit, up-to-date news, and in many cases, the best information available about the spread of the coronavirus pandemic now in the world, where governments are choosing to keep their numbers low or disguise their failures or otherwise find it less than perfectly satisfactory to report honestly on what is going on. As we see that merger between the press, as it used to be, that is, the capitalist organization of reporting and the dissemination of its consequences, and the individual free speech culture of I've got a Facebook page, I have an Instagram account, maybe I even have a web server of my own, and my role is to speak the truth to the world as I see it, that structure it fundamentally is not in accord with the law of the 20th century's First Amendment or with the social understandings that lay under it. But this doesn't require of us revolution. This requires of us reconstruction because, as I say, all of that hinged on an understanding of what the meaning of the word or is. The clear and apparently, whether you took it from a legal historical point of view or a sociological point of view, the clear and evident proposition that really this was one rule against the abridgment of freedom of speech and another rule against the abridgment of freedom of press. That idea was the characteristic view both of the Anglo-American lawyers, including those in the first Congress who drafted the First Amendment, and the Supreme Court of the 20th century, which built the First Amendment's clauses into monuments of world constitutional law. But it isn't what the language means, either in its original context or in our own. It's merely what the language connotes. Where its meaning lies, well, is in the sentence itself and in the nature of what it means to abridge. In my view, this would be a good time to take a rest. Hit pause, and we'll resume shortly. Once we have recognized that the or between the freedom of speech and the freedom of the press is an adjunctive, Congress shall not abridge freedom of speech or of the press, under our contemporary sociological conditions, the merger of speech clause and press clause doctrine then begins to make analytic sense. But when the or between speech and press has ceased to suggest the difference between two realms of social activity or two sets of law, then the remainder of the sentence as a whole falls into place relatively easily. The idea, the sub-idea of the larger idea that there are elements of state civil society with which the legislative power of the empire may not tangle, the sub-idea that there are things that may not be abridged, and they are freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition government for redress of grievances, a single idea now gives us not a petition clause, or an assembly right or clause, any more than it gives us a speech or press clause. We are now looking at a series of facets of the same object, the crystalline ability of the people to conduct their social and political expression like their religious expression, free of certain kinds of state legislative limitation. The petition clause as a clause never quite learned how to flap its wings and wound up in the Norr-Pennington doctrine and, you know, mere subordinate rules concerning the privilege of lobbying the state legislature to screw your business competitors. And the right of the people peaceably to assemble, though in cases like Hague against the CIO, it can eventuate in a broad proposition such that the streets and the parks belong to the people, or that there is at any rate trouble when the state tries to determine who may parade on St. Patrick's Day, or even to allow some private organization to determine in a discriminatory fashion who parades on St. Patrick's Day, the thinness of the doctrines, the limitations of the cases in the soup, suggests that to try and stand these up as particular individual rights maybe at something of a distance from the actual meaning of the constitutional order. Rather, the element which now conjoins these pieces, the physical or virtual assembly of people the submitting of petitions or other forms of pressure to government, and the power of the people to resist legislative encroachment on the way they use their voices, individual, personal, collective, technological, that the idea begins to come straightforwardly into place on a scale that allows clausification to die away. And once we do, we are back again to the importance of the notion of abridgment, both in the form of the foreshortening and in the form of limitation, which is either discriminatory or which permits discrimination. The bridge in these ideas concerns the constitutional status of anonymity. Even in the history of the First Amendment, backloaded as it is into the 20th century, consideration of anonymity is in itself all the more backloaded towards our recent past. The Supreme Court doesn't begin thinking about anonymity as a right in political speech until the mid-1990s. And while the cases about yard signs or the requirements of political petition gatherers to identify themselves speak to anonymity in a direct political speech context, close, as Justice Rehnquist says, to core political speech values, and just as this in itself leads to rumination about the pseudonymous authorship of the Federalist Papers and the long tradition of political pseudonymity in American publication or Anglo-American publication, just as all of this brings up a kind of legal historical past and a geometry of the First Amendment consistent with 20th century technologies, it still yields a fundamental and clear understanding for us under 21st century conditions. The power of the people to speak is not left unabridged when every speaker has to put a name to a communication. In this sense, we can begin to observe in the First Amendment's tentative and late developing protections for political speech an important general principle for 21st century networked society. With respect to state surveillance, with respect to the what used to be science fiction dystopia is now built live in Xinjiang by the Chinese Communist Party as a memorial to the world. In this world of comprehensive state surveillance and data analysis, the purpose, as I pointed out in the post-Snowden lectures, is to make every human activity attributable. The power theorists of the late 20th century and the early 21st, those strategists who began to understand that the next challenge to the American empire after the Cold War would be asymmetric, not great power conflicts, a period which now only seems to be ending. The theorists who understood the American strategic military future as a future of hard power addressed to soft targets took as its basic principle that in the aftermath of bilateral Cold War nuclear deterrence, which was based upon technological similarity and mutual assured destruction, such that if one side launched, the other side would have sufficient survivable strategic nuclear weapons to end attacking society's life and viability, once that form of parity and mutual assured destruction as deterrence was no longer relevant, the theorists of asymmetry, the Rand Corporation thinkers of the early 1990s, the George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, Pentagon. Their assumption was that for deterrence by American power to work in a world of asymmetric conflict, the Americans had to be able to attribute every action. Anything that was done to you or your people, you had to be able to say who did it, because only then could forms of deterrence be applied. And so, whether it was Admiral Poindexter's total information awareness, or the post 9/11/2001 executive orders taking the leash off the American listeners inside the United States, or whether it is now the form of mutual benefit relationship between the parasite with the mind of God and state power in China or the United States or Russia or India, the comprehensive listening and monitoring of society, the use of all those surveillance instruments in your pocket and all that commercial surveillance directed at you in order to give government an opportunity to attribute every human action and most human ideas, this ambition on the part of the state, which has become so common in the 21st century as almost to require no direct notice or discussion, this ambition, well, suffice it to say the First Amendment says you shan't do it. That's really, after all, a form of the abridgment of the right of speech and press, which is fundamental to the ideas of the framers of the document. They are saying, after all, that regimes less onerous than that, but still fundamentally about the attribution of every printed document, the forms of regulation that lay in the constitutional past that the First Congress is, at least in its own mind, firmly prohibiting to the federal government forever, those forms of activity are merely warm-ups, tune-ups for the symphony of surveillance and attribution, which is the ambition of contemporary governments. So if we get nothing else from the pure basic meaning of the sentence, the second half of the sentence that is the First Amendment, well, we might call its non-abridgment portion, the first direct result we get from the non-abridgment portion of the First Amendment is that geofencing everybody who attends a rally or a political event by capturing all the cell phones in the mix and identifying all the people carrying them, or by tagging all the social media posting occurring at a particular place and time, or by keeping track of the personal identifying information of everybody who signs a petition to a government agency online, or who makes a call to a 311-like public receipt spot in the government information system, all of those elements are clearly beyond the power of the legislature to undertake or to permit. For each of them is in one way or another an abridgment of a kind which, while it has a new technological guise, is entirely familiar in the legal logic of the First Amendment as the First Congress drafted it. We are, in other words, now beginning to see that the principle of non-abridgment can also be regarded as a principle protecting anonymity by preventing the forms of chilling of speech that result from the undertaking of surveillance. This idea was raised in the course of the 1960s and 1970s in the United States, in the press between the United States government and the opponents of the Vietnam War. But the question, does it have a chilling effect on speech such that the First Amendment gives standing to individual parties to protest government surveillance of political dissent organizations is resolved to the extent that it's resolved at all on standing grounds. And the power of the United States government to engage in such activities without meeting a First Amendment limitation in Laird against Tatum and similar litigations never resolves itself to clarity. It isn't part of the First Amendment of 1972. It's not even part of the First Amendment of 1995. But out of the materials of the 20th century failure, we can see the First Amendment cases of the future precipitating with substantial certainty. When the library surveils everybody who reads the books in it, then fundamental principles of the First Amendment have gone awry from the point of view even of the 20th century cases. As we can see in the occasional interactions between the rule that placed obscenity outside the realm of First Amendment protection on the one hand and the problem of the library on the other. Thus, we see in the decisions of the justices of the Supreme Court who were most solicitous of the First Amendment in the 20th century, an occasional reflection that the rules that placed expression outside the First Amendment for reason of obscenity could have a terrible effect on libraries. This is the comment made by William Douglas in Paris Adult Theater against Slayton as the court upholds restrictions on the non-obscene street-side advertising of the porno theater discreetly located back from the street on the second floor when he says, apropos the restriction, that this, what we do today, is ominous as respects libraries. The Supreme Court justices' theory of the First Amendment in the 20th century, that is, presumed that there is a zone of our reading and listening which is protected against the spying or the surveillance or the control of the state, even though the library is a public instrumentality. This, then, is the first of the deductions from the principle of non-infringement, which we get by way of the courts developing protection for anonymity, and which in the end discloses that which it burdens all speakers to prove their identity, which allows government to know who is thinking or reading or speaking at any given time, that this is fundamentally an abridgment of the right to freedom of speech or of the press, which includes the right of reading and listening privately. Thus, from the transition from 20th century political speech anonymity to the non-infringement, to the non-abridgment principle protection for the anonymity of reading, we see the process of the creation of the 21st century First Amendment on 18th century principles. The same movement shows us the nature of the outcome with respect to broadcasting. The fairness rule of FCC of red line broadcasting against FCC, the requirement that holders of federal broadcast licenses engage in even-handed discussion of politics, which Red Lion upheld in 1968, is explicitly premised on a technological judgment that the only way to manage scarce electromagnetic spectrum is for government to allocate it, and in the process of allocation may impose requirements of the public service, including even-handed political speech. But Red Lion's outcome, with its premise on technological scarcity, implicitly illuminates the fact that the result runs against the fundamental commitments that the First Amendment visibly embodies. There's no doubt whatever that if the federal government attempted to license newspapers in the District of Columbia, or if a state government in New York or California purported to license the newspapers operating in its jurisdiction, that every single federal judge, from the first district judge to the 9 members of the United States Supreme Court, would altogether find it to be unconstitutional regulation. There are 1,000 cases which deal in one way or another with the impossibility of licensing newspapers, including cases about the mere regulation of the street side boxes for free distribution of newspapers. The clarity with which the court understands that newspaper publication cannot be licensed arises, as we saw, specifically from the long legal history of the licensing of the press as an object and its product as works of printing. The clarity with which the rule against licensing has been maintained throughout, not just in the United States, not just under the Constitution, but in Anglo-American legal history from the reign of William III, is overcome with respect to the fairness doctrine in Red Lion by a technological premise, a faute de mieux. Though we would wish to do something else, there is nothing else that we can do because we are constrained by the technological reality of scarce spectrum. The Supreme Court never returned to the subject of the Fairness Doctrine because the FCC, under the pressure of political realities in the late 20th century, abolished the Fairness Doctrine for itself, thus permitting the existence of phenomena such as that recent Congressional Medal of Honor winner, Rush Limbaugh. The understanding that the Supreme Court would have given, that only the Supreme Court could have given in its broadest constitutional perspective to that result, would have described the way in which under late 20th, let alone 21st century conditions, there is no scarcity of spectrum anymore. The hypothesis that we cannot share spectrum and that government must choose in every event who owns it is no longer reasonable. All our spectrum can be shared the way we share those frequencies we use among our mobile devices or across the internet as a whole, by switching packets for one another rather than by the ownership of spectrum as real estate. The question then arises whether anything other than wholesale distribution of packets should be permitted to those who are allocated spectrum under federal regulation. Whether indeed the allocation of spectrum under federal regulation for private ownership ought not to be on its pathway to obsolescence over time, as shared spectrum uses become more and more important and exclusive rights to particular communications pathways disappear, solely on the constitutional basis that the allowance of rights of large-scale communication through allocation of spectrum to a few favored individuals or organizations inevitably abridges the right of everybody else. This, then, is the principle upon which the First Amendment's non-abridgment principle in the 21st century should be an anti-oligopoly principle, a principle against government's arrangements making exclusive privileges out of what can and ought to be common rights of use. Where spectrum is in the public's hands already, used by government or reserved for public purposes, that reservation doesn't abridge anybody else's rights so long as government is not unduly privileging private parties with remaining spectrum that could usefully be shared. This principle, that abridgment is in itself a step towards oligopoly, and that oligopoly is symbolic of abridgment, is straightforward from the 18th century point of view. All that stands between us and its adoption is our residual 20th century idea of the press, the industrial capital organized forms of information distribution, as somehow necessary to the order of the world. At the opening of the 21st century, I may have been the only law professor in the United States who thought that broadcasting was unconstitutional. Later, Larry Lessig found that he agreed with me, and thereafter, over the course of the first decade of the 21st century, a number of the scholars we had been contesting with oriented towards more conventional economic analyses of the nature of communications rights had begun to come to a similar, if more reluctant, conclusion. This, then, is a crucial example of the meaning for the First Amendment's anti-abridgment structure in the world of the 21st century. But once we have declausified the amendment, once we think about the rights of speech and press and assembly and petition, all as the exercise of the privilege of civil expression, all of them about being who we politically, culturally, religiously are, once we have adopted an understanding of the provision as a whole, then the anti-abridgment principle stands for a broader premise with respect to our forms of civic engagement. Not merely the streets and the parks belonging to the people, not merely the right to petition government by addressing the legislature or the executive concerning our needs, not merely then the pillars or the verticals of the clausified amendment, but rather a principle that in our civic engagement with one another, in our speaking, reading, writing, reading, listening, carrying ourselves in public, both in spaces real and virtual, coming together to request as well as to demand, we are expressing something which it is beyond the power of legislation or executive action in the United States to interfere with. This is, after all, always a matter of reciprocal rights. The right to speak implies the right to hear. The right to read implies the right to print implies the right to read. And the principle of the right to assemble and to petition government implies the right to know, to be informed, to understand. Not to have access for a special party called the press, but rather to have a structure of information which allows the people constant and full access to the truth. The principle is one of our right to know as it is our right to ask on the basis of what we know for what we need. The completion of the system of civic engagement, which it is not government's right to abridge in any way. Now here again, of course, the principle that the 18th century understands is being made available in the 21st in a fashion which Jefferson, or for that matter, James Madison, the primary author of the sentence that is the First Amendment, would completely grasp. That we are no longer engaged in a world in which the process of learning and informing is industrial, but agricultural, that each of us may grow our own, that we have a common presence in this society and a common right to combine, to teach, to learn, to understand, to know, and to express. Of course, it follows from this that we are now also recognizing the First Amendment's commitment to the key questions of our privacy. Secrecy, which we have not in this context yet discussed, we can readily understand. In 1992, at the beginning of the legal dispute with the United States government over pretty good privacy, over the people's right to have strong encryption, I said to John Markoff of the New York Times, the right to speak PGP is like the right to speak Navajo. And by this I meant to indicate that we understand with respect to language itself that we have a right to choose our own mode of expression, and whether the listeners understand it or not is none of the government's business. This ought, in all simplicity, to resolve the current determination by the good, hard-working law enforcement agents and domestic security spies of the United States government, and certainly their Attorney General, William Barr, with respect to the effort to control the use of strong encryption by the platform companies. It is no more constitutional for the United States government to coerce Facebook into not using end-to-end encryption in Facebook Messenger than it would be for government to require everybody to speak English all the time so that the listeners would have an easier job understanding what we're saying. It is not the government's right to invade that zone of communication in which we choose to whisper rather than to shout, or to speak the languages of our own devising rather than those preferred by the listeners. But this is not the only way in which our secrecy is protected against the attribution of our understandings. It is beyond the power of the state of Alabama in NAACP against Alabama to infringe the association rights of the NAACP's membership by forcing NAACP to disclose who in the state of Alabama is a member. The same principle indicates, of course, that it is unconstitutional for the United States government to build that robust social graph of the United States in which the government compiles and maintains a list of everybody every American knows. From our secrecy and our anonymity, then, we are in fact protected in the First Amendment as the First Amendment would expect us to be, in our autonomy, that is to say, in our right to go about the important matters of our lives, in our religion, in our education, in our politics, in our art and culture. It is forbidden to make us go about those activities in our lives under the burden of infringement of our secrecy and our anonymity by government action or government stimulation. This, that we are protected in those decisions that we make, in the ways that we then behave with one another, is what it means to see in our assembly, our petitioning, our worshiping, our speaking, and our writing the signs of a free people. This is how we come together to be the people in a 21st century networked society, and it is the clear meaning of the sentence addressed to us by the First Congress, that in doing so we are protected against the forms of abridgment of our autonomy which rest in the compromise of our secrecy or our anonymity. So here is the comedy of the First Amendment in its most tenable, its most immediate form. The last act of the tragedy in Shakespearean terms, as I observed last time, is that everyone dies. And the last act of the Shakespearean comedy, as the great Shakespearean scholar Joe Barber pointed out, is that everybody marries. It's that marriage of all of us together, our coming together to be the people, which is the object of the First Amendment's concern and the nature of its meaning for us under 21st century conditions. This is the comedy of the First Amendment, short and clear. Our right to be the people beyond the power of government to intervene or to prevent by force of law. There are ways in which other aspects of the First Amendment join to the 21st century meaning of our system of ordered liberty, our constitutional freedoms. But for the moment, this completes the picture of the First Amendment in its own backyard, its fundamental work and the fundamental ease with which it offers us protection for our basic liberties and our basic self-understanding under the harsh conditions of 21st century surveillance by industry and government, and the data of the people belongs to the state in so many parts of the developed and developing world. Next time, we will be thinking about a quite different subject in part six, namely the role of the enterprises of the surveillance, behavior collection, analysis, and its juncture with state power to the system of criminal justice, which the framers of the federal constitution also saw as fundamentally under need of control if the empire was not to threaten the freedom of the people. And in that context, I'll begin next time with some discussion of the role of the First Amendment in the larger constitutional order. But here, it's appropriate just to pay tribute to the degree to which, if we can say, of the Constitution, as Michael Kamen famously did in a history of its popular understanding, that the Constitution was expected to be a machine that would go of itself, an entity of the 18th century clockmaking kind, which was supposed to be capable of protecting the culture of its own devising, to help us, if you like, in Benjamin Franklin's words, to keep the republic that the founders made. And it does. This is the beauty of the First Amendment in its simplicity and its force, that it does what under our circumstances in our world, facing the threats and challenges we face, it does what we in this time of ours most fundamentally need. So much for this week. I wish you an excellent break, healthy and happy wherever you may be. May we come together, or not quite together, in our new socially appropriately distanced form 2 weeks hence, with everybody well and strong and hoping for more freedom now. Thanks.